Thanks very much, John, and to the International Institute for Popular Culture for inviting me to talk today, and thanks for all of you for coming out during the end of term, which I know is a very busy time. And let me know if you need me to project a bit more. My topic today is a much maligned phenomenon that's received little critical attention, the pornographic motion picture peep show arcade. Clustered in tenderloin districts in virtually every metropolitan area, peep show movie machines are mechanized booths offering snippets of pornographic media for the deposit of a coin. My focus will be on one specific moment in the evolution of the peep show, the widespread emergence of adult-specific arcades in North American cities in the mid-1960s. I'm interested during this period in the ways in which film technology and urban architecture were adapted for commercial and social use, and on the complex political and affective exchanges that took place in the space of the arcade, exchanges that register in the aesthetics of the film loops and within the sites where they were consumed. And I know it's bad form to start with caveats, but I do have two to get out of the way before we start. The first is that what I'm going to be presenting is less of a formal talk and more of an outline of a work in progress. This project snowballed from a one-off article into an art exhibition, which I actually got in quite a bit of trouble for doing, and an unwieldy book-length study on single-viewer film technologies and urban culture. So what I'd like to do today is kind of outline some of the broader historical and theoretical aspects of peep show culture that will provide the outline for the book. And I'm particularly motivated by three intersecting facets of the peeps. The first has to do with the adaptation and recycling of technologies that formed the basis for the adult peep show arcade. Second, I'm interested in the strange inversions of public and private space that are manifested within the films themselves. Certain peep films, particularly the softcore, single-performer, striptease loops, make use of direct address and point-of-view shooting styles to achieve a surprising degree of intimacy and arguably a degree of performative agency, unlike other pornographic media. And finally, I'm going to look at questions of filmic spectatorship, which are complicated by both the peep booth apparatus and by the politically charged social space of the arcades. Once again, we find complex reversals between public and private space, and all of these registers are more than I could possibly cover in the course of one talk, but I'll try to hit on each of these registers as I go through some of my examples. My next is less caveat, is really not a caveat, but more potentially a tease. I'm going to be running some of these loops overhead during my talk so you can get a sense of the aesthetics. They're mostly soft core, but there is full frontal nudity and highly suggestive content. So if that's not your bag, I just want to let you know what you're in for, although I suspect you probably guessed from the title. If this is your bag, then you have something to look forward to after I get through all the dense theory. So it's a good experiment for me in divided attention to watch you trying to figure out where to look during the talk. So maybe it's a little sadistic on my part to do that. I think I'll start by saying a little bit about the genesis for this project, which was very circuitous. I did not, in fact, intend to spend the last 5 years of my life researching pornographic peep show films. I was originally working on musical film jukeboxes, the Soundies from the 1940s, and this is a Panoram Soundies jukebox here, and the Scopatones from the 1960s. These were coin-operated machines containing 16mm film projectors that played 3-minute musical shorts. I find these films to be incredibly evocative. They're clumsy, low-budget, poorly synced, and pander to the most stereotypical and literal visualizations of music that one can imagine. At the same time, their disjointed nature held for me a strange affective power. And once when I was speaking about these works, someone remarked that it sounded like I was talking about pornography, and I was taken a bit aback by that comment, but realized there is something, in fact, decidedly perverse about the film jukebox's mode of address. Just to give you a taste here. Okay. And these are two Soundies Panorama films. The Panorama Jukebox was a machine that held an 8-song reel featuring a range of genres and novelty numbers, including a large number of jazz shorts by African-American artists. The target clientele... Oops, sorry. Don't want you to miss the fan dance. The target clientele was middle-aged and male, as evidenced by the preponderance of cheesecake in the reels. Nearly every Soundie, regardless of genre or lyrical content, contained a group of provocatively dressed girls dancing or posing in the background. A common plot point involved women with ruffled panties bending over repeatedly to pick things up. There were a large number of burlesque-style numbers featuring dancers such as Sally Rand. These numbers were sure to draw repeat customers. The machine didn't allow you to select a particular number. You had to just keep putting quarters in until the number you wanted came along in the reel. So these kinds of dances were a good way to ensure a good profit. I later serendipitously stumbled upon a reference to Martin Hodes, the peep show king of 42nd Street. There's Martin. Hodes had been working in the coin-operated vending circuit in the tri-state region for over a decade when he ran across some antiquated 16mm film machines in an arcade in New Jersey in 1966 and got the idea to rig them with girly films and install them in adult bookstores in Times Square, launching the smut explosion of the late 60s and early 1970s and building for himself a vast porn empire. The machines that were described in this account struck me as sounding remarkably similar to the 1940s Soundies jukeboxes, and I became fixated with the idea that there might be some connection between the two technologies. And it turns out my suspicions were correct. The Panorama jukeboxes were converted to run girly films in the Peep arcades, and Martin Hodes is actually listed in the phone book, and I was able to call him and confirm that these were in fact the machines that he did convert. When the Soundies Corporation folded in 1947, the abandoned machines scattered across the U.S. were often recycled in this manner. The large format screens were boarded over, as you can see here, and binocular viewers were installed. I became fascinated with the ways in which the entrepreneurial adaptation of antiquated technologies would later dovetail with a series of transformations taking place in urban culture in general, and in New York Times Square in particular. All of this research on the films and machines coincided with a litany of legal cases, zoning regulations, and public debates regarding the design and operation of arcades and urban vice centers. As I immersed myself in this material, it became increasingly clear that the Peep Arcade as a phenomenon provided a fascinating forum for rethinking some of the basic tenets of film studies. Unlike the isolated, hermetic model of the theatrical film apparatus, where the passive viewer remains immersed in a womb-like space, entranced by the screen, the arcade model is porous, active, social, and geared toward a range of practices and activities, only some of which are actually focused on watching the films. It's also a site of unabashed and unapologetic commercial traffic. There are a series of equivalencies and exchanges that take place in the peep show booth, whereby a coin is equated with a certain duration of filmic experience. Commodification and fetishization are the explicit modus operandi of these spaces. I had begun to call this messy accumulated research my pornographic arcades project as a bit of a joke, playing off the title of Walter Benjamin's fragmentary, unfinished masterwork, The Arcades Project. The Arcades Project, which consists of a series of disconnected quotations and Benjamin's own reflections, centers on the glass and iron-covered passageways that sprang up throughout 19th-century Paris. These domed structures, which were meant to facilitate urban shopping, fostered social ecosystems populated by a rich cast of characters, most famously the dandy-like flaneur, who would wander aimlessly throughout the arcades, turning himself into a spectacle much like the commodities on display in the shop windows. The arcades for Benjamin provided the fodder for a materialist history of modernity. Beneath the glass, commodities and advertisements proliferated, their carcasses washing up in cluttered piles and junk shops throughout the malls. This pop cultural detritus for Benjamin provided an image of a moment, insights into the preoccupations of an era, its interiors put on public display. Reviewing some of the thematic categories that Benjamin used to organize his observations, fashion, advertising, the automaton, gambling, prostitution, and economic history, I begin to wonder if the Peep Arcades of New York might, in their own way, offer us a kind of material history of our own contemporary preoccupations. Indeed, a great number of the factors we might associate with the onset of late capitalism or postmodernism have a great deal to do with the transformation of urban spaces such as Times Square during this period. And this is a map from a study that was conducted by the City of University of New York in the 1970s, which was used to provide materials for the U.S. Attorney General's report on obscenity and pornography, which is one of the most important documents in the United States to deal with pornography and censorship. So these are all the different adult sexual entertainment businesses in the Times Square area circa 1979. So I'm just going to outline some of the cultural resonances that I see happening in Times Square in the 1960s and early 1970s that might shed light on this project. So during this time period, we witness major shifts in the nature of public space in New York. On the one hand, you have figures like Robert Moses with projects like the Cross Bronx Expressway that plowed through existing communities. The glut of large-scale corporate construction that dominated the urban landscape was beginning to crumble under its own weight by the end of the 1960s, often at the expense of local neighborhood culture. Public housing projects created a further artificial divide between classes and neighborhoods. On the other hand, groundswells in various civil rights movements were transforming street culture. Women had an increasing presence on the street as workers and commuters. African American and Latino populations made up an increasing percentage of New York's demographic, and by the end of the 1960s, gay men had an unprecedentedly visible place in the streets of New York. Peep Arcades presented a space for what Sam Delaney has called cross-class communion. The arcades were porous venues through which, under the veil of anonymity, any number of participants might pass through or convene with one another. It's important to note that the clientele of the arcades during this era was almost exclusively male, and I found in researching arcades across North America, they were dominated by regional regulations and regional uses of technology, but the one thing that seemed to be consistent was a ban on minors and a ban oftentimes on women entering the arcades. So it's if I talk about the users of these film booths during this time period being male, it's because that was in some ways regulated. And the women were allowed in smaller numbers later, but there has not been a female audience, nor were any of these products really designed for female use, which is obviously quite important to think about. The street culture of New York and Times Square in particular further intersected with transformations. The exclusion of women as participants in these kinds of public spaces is highly problematic, and the increasing visibility of Peep Arcades and dirty bookstores, in fact, spurred a backlash among anti-pornography feminists who staged a number of interventions to take back the streets. That said, the public forum that Peep Arcades provided was dynamic, diverse, and of particular importance for many marginalized groups, particularly gay men, drug dealers, hustlers, and some prostitutes as well. The street culture of New York and Times Square in particular further intersected with transformations in the New York art world. In the early 1970s, Brazilian artist Helio Etosica created pod-like installation spaces in his downtown loft and multimedia quasi-cinema events with projected images and cocaine drawings that riffed off of commercial advertising imagery. Gordon Matta Clark's building cuts bored holes in the sides of architectural structures, destabilizing notions of solidity, of interior and exterior, reframing our perspective and position as we move through the city. This is one of his works, Day's End, from 1975, which cut a big slice out of Pier 52 on the west side, which was an abandoned pier that was also a location for a lot of gay male cruising. And Alvin Baltrop, the photographer, took a lot of stunning images, including this one, and photographs of the pier in general, sometimes using Mata Clark's Day's End as a framing device, depicting the looming architectural space as it was populated by male bodies, copulating, cruising, and moving through the open air. Perhaps the most salient link for me, however, is the work of Andy Warhol. Warhol would frequent the Times Square theaters with film archivist and filmmaker Jonas Mekas, and had this to say about the... I have my other caveat, I have to swear a lot and say dirty things, so... apologies. He had this to say about the beaver films he saw there in an interview. So the interviewer asks, "It's been suggested that your stars are all compulsive exhibitionists and that your films are therapy. What do you think? Have you seen any beavers? They're where girls take off their clothes completely, and they're always alone on a bed. Every girl is always on a bed, and then they sort of fuck the camera. They wiggle around and exhibit themselves. Yeah, you can see them in theaters in New York. The girls are completely nude and you can see everything. They're really great. Have you actually made a beaver yet? Not really. We go in for artier films for popular consumption, but we're getting there. Like, sometimes people say we've influenced so many other filmmakers, but the only people we've really influenced is that beaver crowd. The beavers are so great, they don't even have to make prints. They have so many girls showing up to act in them. It's cheaper just to make originals than to have the prints made. It's always on a bed. It's really terrific." I'm going to return to this question of automation later, but it's fascinating to me that this model of the peep show loop resonated so much with Warhol's larger philosophy. What other artist was more attuned to the nuances of advertising and pornography, those two industries that deal in surfaces in the human form as the ultimate commodity? In self-presentation as a mode of being and a mode of working. With his factory located on East 47th Street, Warhol's work seems an extension and amplification of Times Square's ethos. Certainly there was some direct traffic between these realms. Kathy Acker once reminisced, "I was working at Fun City, a combination magazine and peep show emporium and a fake sex show theater. My boss's nephew, who worked in this family concern as the video booth cleaner, was friends with Joe D'Alessandro, who was one of the biggest stars in Warhol's later era crew. In fact," Acker continues, "one of the lines in our sex show was that we were waiting to be discovered by Andy Warhol. We weren't entirely joking, but we were hoping." Even more telling for me, however, is the aesthetic affinity between these sets of works. Machine aesthetics are, of course, key to Warhol's philosophy. Many of his silkscreen portraits originated as photo booth strips taken in the coin-operated booths located near the factory in Times Square. It's no accident, I would argue, that the photo booths so closely resemble the motion picture peep machines nearby, and it was not uncommon for photo booth patrons to disrobe inside. The art dealer Holly Solomon recalls her own photo booth session with Warhol. "We went to Broadway and 47th Street where they had this photo booth. Andy met me there and we had a bunch of quarters. He was very particular about which booth. We tried a bunch of them. Actually, if you're in a photo booth for a long time, it gets pretty boring. Being photographed, anyway, is pretty boring. After you do one pose, how many poses can you do? I got so bored that I started to really act in them. $50 is a lot in a photo booth." And apparently, Holly Solomon told Wayne Kostenbaum that she was dismayed when she saw the first silk screens that Warhol created from her photo booth strips as, quote, "she thought it made her look like a cocksucker." So surfaces here serve not as masks, shielding an inner truth, I would say both in the peep show loop and in Warhol's art, but as an end in themselves, an endless series. What is exposed is not the flesh or the self, but the perpetual necessity of performing that self, performing for and against all those other performers. Being sexed, Warhol philosophized, is hard work. We strip ourselves, dress ourselves up again in a perpetual, repetitive loop. Peep loops might be unique, original artifacts, but they are simultaneously completely automatic, utterly replaceable, fleshy, sustainable commodities. The body in this economy is a vehicle for exchange that traffics the porous boundary between public and private, between product and person, between perception and bodily reflex. Being seen is a form of work. And I think we could link this to Michael Hart and Antonio Negri's notions of effective labor here, which I think also interestingly they link with precisely this, this time period as effective labor's point of emergence. The product being sold here is our own visceral response. And yet the sheer tenacity of the repetitiveness is somehow captivating and revealing. Something excessive is generated in the exchange. Something unforeseen is exposed. The peep loop, in this sense, is a transfixing historical image. So these are some of the theoretical questions that have motivated my research. For the time that's left, I'm going to speak in more detail about the arcades and loops. But before I launch into that, I have one more conceptual model that I found useful in theorizing these overlapping registers of the peep loop, and that is the model of the parasite. And in particular, I found numerous points of resonance between acts of pornographic adaptation and the figure of the hermit crab, those decapods that scavenge abandoned shells and human refuse, adapting their bodies to fit within these makeshift homes. The notion of a parasitic inhabitation speaks directly to me to the relationship between pornographic and legitimate economies. If the commercial media sphere represents an ecosystem of sorts, the rubbish of this system is often processed and recycled for pornographic sale. While this activity might be dismissed as culturally marginal, the economic force is undeniable. I'd further argue that the kinds of mutual transformations that occur through the process of pornographic adaptation tell us much about the wider climate of a particular cultural moment. These transformations are evidenced not only within the content of the media displayed, but in the social context in which the technologies are used. The types of processes I'm going to discuss go beyond the adaptation of a singular text or a singular machine, but involve instead the systematic transformation of public spaces into arcades of illicit commerce. The repositioning of an individual coin-operated film machine into arcades of peep booths, for example, set the stage for contingent types of social occupation. So in each of these registers, the texts of the films, the technology, and the larger cultural and social sphere, I'll point to some of the ways in which I see a parasitic strategic inhabitation taking place. So to shift back to Mr. Martin Hodes, he was in fact one of just several entrepreneurs who co-opted pre-existing film technology for pornographic purposes. He had run across, as I mentioned, this panoramic jukebox that had already been adapted to show burlesque films. Retrofitted panorams were often placed in entertainment arcades that featured a range of devices, such as pinball machines and games of skill. These arcades were open to mixed audiences, and the content of the loops was often pretty tame, although a number of obscenity charges were brought up against individual proprietors. So Martin Hodes didn't invent the peep booth as such, but he was instrumental in launching the pornographic arcade as a visible urban institution. He purchased a large number of discarded panorams, convinced adult bookshop owners in Times Square to allow him to install and service groups of machines. He took advantage of changes in censorship laws and loopholes in zoning regulations to establish a thriving franchise. It's rumored that at the height of his operations, 85% of the quarters deposited at the Chemical Bank branch on 42nd Street and 8th Avenue came from peep show arcades, which is rather staggering. I should also mention that doing this archival research has been very challenging because pornographers are not particularly known for keeping great records of their finances, and there's also a lot of allegations of involvement of organized crime, so many of these stories are probably fabricated and exaggerated by the participants, so it's good to bear that in mind, although I think that adds a bit to the story. At the same time that HOTUS was building his empire, like-minded entrepreneurs across the United States were engaging in similar acts of technological co-optation. In Atlanta, for example, Michael Fevis built a massive multimedia porn empire funded by the distribution of peep show machines developed from 8mm children's cartoon booths, the kinds that you would find at the entrances to discount stores. Reuben Sturman built a massive franchise out of Cleveland, founded on old film projectors and booths that he built out of plywood, and these had the advantage of closing doors and the ability to select specific 8mm films. In each instance, scavenged technologies were used only as long as they were useful. Adaptations for privacy were implemented, smaller projectors and larger coin boxes were installed, and motion picture film was abandoned in favor of video and later digital servers soon after those technologies came on the market. So this is the first example I'd give of a kind of strategic parasitic occupation, the creative adaptation of technological devices coinciding with a manipulation of civic codes, as well as recognition of a social need not being met by existing media institutions. I'd liken this occupation to Deleuze and Guattari's discussion of counterpoint, which occurs at the intersections of diverse territories. Rooting their formulations in the natural world, there's a focus in their discussion on the social and political alliances that occur between species and between species and environments. And frequently, their biological examples take a parasitic form, which is why I'm going to try to assert that hermit crabs make sense here. On the death of a mollusk, Deleuze and Guattari write, the shell that serves as its home becomes the counterpoint of the hermit crab that turns it into its own habitat. The tick is organically constructed in such a way that it finds its counterpoint in any mammal, whatever, that passes below its branch. I would argue that this notion of a contingent, adaptive, scavenger-like modality is the best means by which to understand pornography's modus operandi in infiltrating and propagating within our media ecosystem. Certainly, press coverage of the emergence of the peep arcade tended toward metaphors of parasitic infiltration, permeating decent communities like a virus or vermin or weed. Pornography is ubiquitous, tenacious, and threatens to choke out or infect the healthy law-abiding tax-paying system into which it's introduced. A survey of journalistic coverage of the growth of pornography shops and peep arcades reveals a preponderance of such metaphors. Peep shows were said to proliferate in Tenderloin districts, while court decisions loosening obscenity restrictions unleashed an invasion of organized crime and commercial sex operations, what Time magazine deemed a porno plague. I can in fact think of no better model for describing pornographers than the hermit crab. To paraphrase a scientific study of those creatures, scavengers and detritus feeders who scour shorelines seeking abandoned shells to inhabit, devouring for their survival carrion, fecal matter, rotten vegetation, and the decaying stomach contents of deceased animals. The seeming ubiquity of the pornography industry may be tied to its similarly Catholic feeding habits. Few technologies, genres, narratives, character types, or scenarios have remained untouched by pornographic adaptation. Just as hermit crabs' own bodies are adapted to fit the shape of their salvaged homes, pornographic media retains a remarkable malleability and resiliency in its occupation of new technological venues. What we find here is that technologies, networks, and narratives that are taken up and inhabited by pornographic adaptation are taken out of circulation from the legitimate market economy, deterritorialized, as it were, transcoded and re-territorialized within a new economy. The shell becomes the temporary venue for an alien value system. The Panorama Jukebox, for example, would have had a very different life cycle as a commodity had it not been transcoded in this manner. To borrow from Michael Thompson's rubbish theory, as the machines lost their initial use value, being reduced to rubbish, they might regain a certain value over time as fetish objects, collectibles or antiques revered with nostalgia. Yet the pornographic occupation of the Panoram is irreverent, undertaken with an utter disregard for the original purpose or history of the machine. It was a means toward an end when that means became no longer advantageous, the shell was discarded for a more adaptable technology and design. So you can think of the difference. Some of these machines still exist on eBay, where they're incredibly valued and fetishized because of their history, but the pornographic adaptation is completely unsentimental. And here's, I'll get to the good bits now that you've been waiting for. The roots of the motion picture peeping machine, of course, extend far beyond the 1960s. The arcade booths of the mid-20th century share much in common with Tom Gunning's description of the 19th century cinema of attractions. The spectator here does not get lost in a fictional world and its drama, but remains aware of the act of looking, the excitement of curiosity and its fulfillment. In the peep loops, the filmed body is highly aware that it is being watched. It addresses the camera directly, enacting an intimate corporeal performance for an individual viewer. The association I draw between pornography and the cinema of attractions is not a new one, yet the interface of the coin-op film machine manifests this legacy in a highly specific manner. The body of the viewer, too, is explicitly acknowledged by the apparatus of the booth, machines in public foyers that seduce passers-by with the promise of the curious and the new. The public display of the viewer's own body would almost surely generate sensations of self-consciousness that would discourage complete spectatorial absorption. And much like early cinematic shorts, the pornographic peep show loop provides, to quote Gunning again, a succession of thrills potentially limited only by viewer exhaustion. And a note of this film as well, I didn't realize until several times after watching it and someone pointing out to me that Lucy's wearing a nursing bra, which I found completely changed my reading of this rather phenomenal film. The act of peeping necessitates a degree of visual disengagement with one's immediate surroundings, assuming a pose that allows for an ocular encounter with a space, either real or representational, accessible through some threshold. This disengagement is hardly passive or involuntary, as the peeper actively peeps in the hopes of experiencing sensation and pleasure, whether or not the material viewed is purient or not. The space viewed and the actions of the bodies potentially performing within that space may ostensibly trigger a corporeal response in the viewer. Yet the eye must work, navigating and exploring the viewed scene to extract perceptions that the brain and nervous system answer to and amplify. Peeping apparatuses are designed to heighten such exchanges, utilizing perspective, depth of field, and framing, in addition to content, to provide the viewer with a sensational, sensuous encounter. The diegetic spaces of peep show loops do vary considerably, particularly as quasi-narrative hardcore loops began to appear in the 1970s. The earlier striptease films, however, make use of an extreme economy of means to construct a space of sexual encounter. And I'm going to show two loops here that were produced by a company out of Seattle in Washington State. And these are both examples of what I'm calling the solo girl loops. Certainly more sophisticated loops utilized first-person perspective to encourage the viewer to identify with the camera person. Here the performer engages with the camera person directly through eye contact, gesture, and posture. The settings are domestic, frequently limited to a single room with a spare use of props. On-screen performers are typically positioned on couches or beds, flirtatiously removing their clothing in a performative display that resists, to my mind, readings of sadistic voyeurism. The camera work is intimate and close, roaming up and down the performer's body, paying copious attention to textures and fabrics, lingerie, skin, eyelashes, lips, breasts, and in the more explicit loops, genitalia. Ideally, these tactile images will coincide with the viewer's own affective bodily experiences. This modality verges on what Laura Marx refers to as a haptic vision, where the distance between viewer and object is collapsed, and the eye is, quote, more inclined to move than to focus, to graze than to gaze. This intense focus on surfaces and textures and certain loops, while by no means removed from a sexual economy that fetishizes the female body, shifts the dynamic from one of optical mastery toward an intersubjective visceral exchange, a co-committant loss of the self in the presence of the other. And those little frames that you just saw were the slugs that would come up, where the film would be on a timer to stop and wait for you to put in your next quarter. Yet this encounter is not experienced unproblematically, and while the peep machine invites a certain interpenetration of space, it is not fully successful in delivering it. The peep show patron may try, perhaps desperately, to achieve an immersive embodied experience through the apparatus, yet absorption is thwarted at every turn by the quality of the image, by the distractions of the lights and sounds and the smells of the arcade, by the constant movement of other bodies outside the booth. Inevitably, the experience will be cut short by the machine itself, violently severing the flow to demand the insertion of another quarter. In considering the physical experience of the arcade, we should not assume that all viewers wish to fully disengage from the space of the present, particularly those that were cruising for more fully embodied sexual encounters. Nor should we assume that the tension between filmed and real worlds within the booth was experienced as pure frustration. Given the continued popularity of the arcades, it seems more likely that this tension may evoke certain pleasures of its own. The body of the viewer hovers in a suspended existence between the body of the film and the space of the arcade, hyper-focused, at least in the case of certain viewers, on the tactility of the flesh on screen, as well as on the sensations of his own flesh. He's also conscious of the synesthetic realm around him, the constant possibility of intrusion of the space of the booth, either welcome or unwelcome, by other patrons, by management or vice cops, or by the machine itself. The peeps indeed seem to revel in a contradictory in-between space, on every register governed more by disruption, surveillance, chance, and displacement, what we might call a masochistic mode, than by visual erotic mastery. If peep shows aim to be voyeuristic, they typically fail in achieving that state, offering the aspiration of ocular embodiment with only the partial fulfillment of that promise. This question of automation is interesting to consider here. This is one of the places I'd see some historical precedents folded into or adapted into a new context. I'm not sure if people are familiar with anatomical Venuses, but these were fascinating 18th century wax models that toe an ambiguous line between science and art and titillation. So these were ostensibly created for medical students and scientists to learn about anatomy, but there's obviously an incredible amount of artistry that goes into the posing of these models that has very, very little to do with scientific discovery. And some of the anatomical Venuses were automatons that would appear to be kind of breathing as they heave their guts all over the displays. I'd see the peep machine actually keying into a similar modality, a morbid quest for reanimation. Descriptions of the 1940s Panorama jukebox always noted that the device was the size of a refrigerator or a coffin, and I think both of those comparisons are rather telling. There's a desire in the coin-operated film booth to encapsulate and to entomb, to grant the viewer the ability to reanimate through the insertion of a coin. When the filmic body subject to automation is the eroticized female body, that dynamic can be particularly politically fraught. So that said, I'd argue that the myriad contradictions and failures present in the peep loop create the space for another kind of inhabitation, in this instance by the female performers on screen. And I'm going to flip here through some stills from various peep loops. In his essay on masochism, Gilles Deleuze identifies two stages in fetishism, a desire for scientific observation and subsequently a state of mystical contemplation. In this sense, the Peep Arcade is profoundly fetishistic. There's a reason why I'm particularly interested in this period beginning in the mid-1960s. We see here first that initial strategic occupation of an outmoded technology and untapped urban space. Second, because of restrictions on decency and the heavy policing of these new arcades, the content of these films was often restricted to the solo girl striptease films or pseudo-lesbian groping sessions. In this early period, loops were often produced explicitly for the peep machines with a bare economy of means. And you'll find after this period in the 1970s, films, most of the machines were running on 8mm film, and the peep arcades would also be bookstores that sold films over the counter, and they would use the booths basically to advertise films, hardcore films that you could then purchase for home use, which was not the case in this earlier period. So thus, these loops are distinct from longer format films, especially those with a narrative framework, and from stag loops, which, because they were distributed underground, were far more explicit. The early portrait loops differ from those later arcade booths, which were the kind that you could buy on the home market. I also feel obligated to note that my reading of these loops is almost certainly skewed by the fact that I'm not the target audience. A female academic watching porn loops in a corner of the Kinsey archive today is probably going to experience a different kind of effective experience than a male commuter on 42nd Street circa 1968, and I'm surely drawn toward different aspects of the image than those viewers. That said, I think it's still possible to speak about the unique and unusual effective power of these early peep show films. I'd locate this power in part in the tension between motion and stillness manifest within the peeps. You have first the gestures of the performers, whose movements are often limited to the transition between cliched poses. Deleuze, in his essay on masochism, identifies a similar tendency in the woman torturer, who freezes into postures that identify her with a statue, a painting, or a photograph. The real cruel mistress here, however, is not on screen, but is the machine itself, that entity that freezes motion at abstract, measured intervals, suspending the viewer's spectatorial pleasure. This stands in contrast to the less regulated movements on screen. And ultimately, what I find effectively compelling in these works are the obvious breaks, disruptions, and stutters that destabilize the fetish image. The performers on screen occupy that space in embodied ways that often exceed the fetishistic premise. Each performance is unique, with varying degrees of control, but in all there's an explicit visual interaction with the camera. The impact is not of a sadistic controlling one, or absent one, but more often one of uncertainty. Certain loops, the loops were usually 10 to 12 minutes in length during this time period, during the course of which many of the performers ran short of material. They often burst into laughter or began playing with props, like hula hoops, that, for me at least, burlesque the fantasies that they appeal to. I watched one series where there was a plastic potted plant in the background of about six loops, and there was finally one really inspired performer who turned around and started making out with the potted plant, which I found rather hilarious. Even in more mundane loops, where we see what we see performed might best be described not as sex, but the performer's imperfect idea of what sexiness on screen ought to look like. I'm reminded of Judith Butler's observation, heterosexuality is always in the process of imitating and approximating its own phantasmatic idealization of itself and failing. The most direct point of reference I can make here is again to Andy Warhol's Screen Tests, films in which subjects were asked to sit still in front of a camera for the duration of a 3-minute roll of film, their gaze confronting the viewer, who slowly observes the performance as it disintegrates before the unblinking camera. Peeps, at least of the direct address solo girl variety, seem to enact a similar encounter. They exist at arm's length, and involve a self-conscious exchange that registers both in the viewer's body and that of the performer as she actively struggles to sustain her performance in the absence of a guiding directorial force. I'd point to another movement at play in certain loops, the haptic nature of the handheld camera work. The textures of the body become one with textiles and surfaces of the domestic space. I find myself drawn to minutiae, a tiny bruise on the actress's hip, a broken fingernail, and in particular to the decor, the textures of the drapery and upholstery and walls. Much has been said about the sleazy, bare settings for porn films. I find this not to be the case here, as there are numerous artifacts, loaded bookshelves, toiletries, record players, and knickknacks that make these seem like lived-in spaces. As the movements of the performers begin to blur into repetition, it is in fact within the decor that I locate certain moments of intimacy or even of intrusion. The interior, private space of the room has been laid bare and in many ways feels more legible than the exposed interiors of the bodies on display. In the larger context of the space of the arcade, however, this question of excess or agency is further complicated. The peep show film apparatus is set up according to a sexist premise. The movements of the women on screen are controlled by a technological interface, animated by the user who dictates when she starts and stops. We might challenge this reading, as I've suggested, by looking to the occupation of the diegetic space by the women on screen. At least in the series of films I'm considering here, the performers have a relative degree of autonomy, evidenced by the effective surplus they're able to generate. To return to the question of automation, we might argue that the notion of the female image as a fetish to be controlled by the viewer is in fact a ruse to obscure us from seeing the ways in which the bodies of the viewers in the arcade are in fact the ones being animated through their interactions with the machine, animated with each stop of the timer for another deposit. If the culture industry is a reenactment of the motions and dynamics of capitalist production, is it not true that the productive labor in the peep arcade is to be found in the various automated gestures of the figures lined up before the rows of identical machines? And this is where I'd find an opening for another, perhaps more radical kind of strategic occupation. While the generation of deposits is the explicit goal of the peep machine, the arcades themselves are sites for all kinds of alternating practices, such as cruising, hustling, drug dealing, and prostitution. The peep show is, in fact, one of the few areas of cinema culture where the activities of spectators receive greater attention than the content of the films. A number of sociological studies on adult bookstores were conducted in the 1970s, providing some of the most detailed accounts on record of the technology, as well as the physical organization of the arcades at the time. The reports, which often read as excessively clinical, tend to stress the anonymity of these spaces and the lack of social contact between patrons. The anxiety about contact appears to stem, according from these studies, from a fear of being identified as well as a fear of being caught engaging in unsanctioned sexual activity. Visible public masturbation would be one such activity, as would be being propositioned for a sexual encounter, of being caught participating in sexual encounters with another man, or even of experiencing arousal when viewing male bodies. That this anxiety would be so pronounced in these studies says something about the range of activities and media that were readily available in adult stores. And I should mention that during this time period, I've seen mostly records of, I haven't seen any records of all male bookstores or arcades, those certainly emerged later in the 1970s, but in the early period, it appears that almost all of these stores sold both male, female, and all male pornography, as well as a range of specialized fetish subgenres. The privatization of peep booths that began to appear in the early 1970s, the initial booths were the panoramas where the viewer's body would be outside looking into the machine. Later machines created blinders and doors and curtains to shield the viewer. This privatization provided greater opportunity for the consumption of pornographic loops to coincide with live sexual experiences. Peep arcades were obvious locales for cruising. Enclosed peep booths were riddled with glory holes for exchanges between various patrons. The impression I take from these accounts, which include both academic description and personal recollections, is that of a supermarket of preferences and perversities. What booth or bookshelf one stood in front of was an indication of what one was into. At the same time, it seemed as though these options were far more fluid and open than they appeared to be outside the confines of the store. The process of selection appears highly performative as well, made with the explicit understanding that one's performance was being observed, and that in the end, one's body was on display as one of the many options another might choose. And it is a social aspect of the peep arcades, far more than the content of the films, that generated the most animosity toward the format. I believe that legislative movements toward the privatization of sexuality must be read in this light. The content of the films rarely emerges as a source of concern in regulation of peep show arcades, yet nearly all the regulations concern lighting, the width of passageways, surveillance mechanisms, and limitations on the size of individual booths. The primary concern here, in short, is not the textual content of what's being shown on screen, but the policing of public sexuality. Cruising is indeed an illicit inhabitation of the space of the arcade, introducing into it a whole new decentralized economy of pacts, connections, and exchanges negotiated between myriad participants in various strata. While I don't want to over-romanticize these practices, it's inevitable that the exchanges taking place were constrained by and bound to be re-territorialized within the codes of the larger socius. Nevertheless, I believe it's worth stressing the historical importance of porn arcades within the political landscape of the 1960s. And here's something for the boys, just to make sure we have diverse offerings. So this is one of the primary reasons why I'm interested, again, in this particular period in peep show history. In the pre-Stonewall era, and the Stonewall Uprising, I'm not sure if you know about, was in 1969, where kind of landmark in terms of the gay rights movement, when patrons of the Stonewall Bar rose up against police brutality in terms of cracking down on gay arcades. In this pre-Stonewall era, when the brutal policing and harassment of gays and lesbians was the established norm, the peep arcade was one of the few visible public spaces open to the queer community and other marginalized persons. The architecture of the arcades, viewed from a social perspective, is not an isolated pod for ocular contemplation, but a series of nodes, of possible connections or breaks, transected by a warren of dimly lit passageways, in constant tension with the panoptic surveillance mechanisms of management and vice officers. As John Champagne has argued, many peep arcade participants didn't even watch the films at all, or were happy to run loops of any sort of persuasion whilst they were otherwise occupied. The specific content of the films, in other words, may be entirely irrelevant for those who might use the machines as a cover for their own effective performances. And I really can't compete with a man to remember. To wait for the punchline. Yes, he does. All right, it's too hard to concentrate with that happening. And indeed, what better way to parasitically inhabit the filmic apparatus than to penetrate it with a glory hole, taking the machine, as it were, from behind? And I don't have time to get into too much detail here, but the solo boy loops I've seen demonstrate, I think, a kind of destabilization of the teleological narrative trajectories that correlate, I think, to the solo girl loops. The loop mechanism might stop at any point in the reel, which decenters the money shot as a finale, which you always have in full-length narrative pornography. And the copious attention paid to gesture surfaces in the male body challenges traditional ways of representing gender and corporeality. There's always the chance, too, that one will encounter a truly unique performance as well, one that reminds us that we do not yet know what the body can do. So to conclude, the peep arcade presents a highly anomalous media terrain, a liminal space between public and private, deeply penetrated by social and political regimes. On each of the registers I've touched on, the technological, the textual, and the space of the exhibition, I've been struck by a series of reversals and inversions stemming from the indeterminacy of space as well as time. The past, filmic and technological and historical, is reanimated while the body remains rooted in the present. Interior spaces, corporeal and domestic, are open to view while the exterior realm of the public foyer is enveloped within the enclosed space of the booth. Just as the filmed body exists in a suspended yet politically charged space between exposure and intimacy, the bodies in the arcade enact a self-conscious performance that is at once personal and socially contingent. Moreover, the operations of the interface threaten to disrupt the illusory act of peeping at the same time that they add to the pleasure of this contradictory experience. By viewing this phenomenon as a multifaceted assemblage, the material fragments of a historical image, we're better able to grasp not only the means by which the pornographic economy scavenges and feeds from legitimate forms of media production, legitimate in scare quotes, but also the ways in which that process provides the foundation for new modalities of viewing the body and for new collective social practices. Thank you.